difficult we perceive. There's one thing that has obviously, I think, needs some clarification, judging by some of the questions I've been getting on the side and so on. When I say every text or every part of the Old Testament refers to Christ, I think you've got to think carefully what is meant by the word text. In my book, a text is something that you have to work at to determine its limits. There are some aspects of a text which are just part of the texture of the description or something. And I wouldn't even spend time trying to work out how, you know, a minor aspect of description of something is fulfilled in Christ or testifies to Christ. Some of it might and some of it might not. One of the things that encourages me to think more in terms of the broader aspect of a text as a whole. It does require, and I think this is an important part of doing exegesis and how you sermonize and so on, is how much of the actual biblical text you take as your unit. And one of my professors at Union Seminary in Virginia gave us all a paper on sort of principles of exegesis, and his first point was you simply establish contact with the text, but you have to establish also what you regard and what can be regarded as the limits of the text. That is, how many verses in your Bible actually belong together as a unit. Now, texts may also belong together with other, you know, further texts. But what is the unit that you can reasonably take as something to preach on or to teach from? I was reminded of something like this when we were dealing with the Book of Daniel at college, and we're doing it again in our home group at church. And you may remember how when Daniel has these weird visions, and he sees all these incredibly strange things happening, then an angel comes along and stands by him and says, "Do you understand what you see?" And Daniel says, "My head hurts." And the angel says, "This is what it means." And if you put down the things that Daniel has described that he's seen, and you put down in a column beside it the things that the angel interprets, you'll see that the angel only interprets the salient features, whereas some people sort of want to sail in and say, you know, the three teeth mean this, or the four talons mean that, and this little bit means something and that little bit means something, whereas the angel wasn't fussed by that sort of thing at all. The angel came along and said, you know, this big picture, which with all the little bits and pieces in it, which are just part of the texture of the painting, if you like. And I think if we, you know, it's part of the art of literature that instead of treating all literature as a sort of a flat kind of thing, some literature is more like a painting. And you don't rush up to the Mona Lisa and say, you know, what's this little bit in the background all about? And what's this little bit down here? It's just part of the thing made that goes to make the whole thing. And I think we have to sort of develop a bit of that approach when we're dealing with the biblical text. Because remember, the biblical writers were in their own way, and according to their own culture, literary artists. And they don't have a sort of clinical sort of, you know, biological dissection approach to their literature. So that's just sort of a sort of a caveat on how you come to the biblical text. So when I say that everything refers to Jesus, I'm thinking more in the terms of literary units and what that literary unit is about. I also would say that not every text, again, a fairly undefined word, is as central as every other text. That is, there are some texts which are so central to the main message of God, and others which are more peripheral. One of my one of the faculty members at Union Seminary used to say there are some texts on the Old Testament he doesn't think he could preach from and didn't think you should preach from. Now, I don't know that I'd agree with that. But I can think that there are a lot of texts that, given the priority of, I don't have that much time left, you know, even if I lived to 90, and even if I preached every Sunday or even twice a Sunday, I still wouldn't be able to get through the whole thing. And anyway, who'd be around to listen to me? So I think all of us engage in a certain amount of prioritising when it comes to determining what we want to preach on and what we want to teach about. Okay, well, the topic which is down in your notes for this last session today is the aim of sermons on the Old Testament. And once again, I mean, you know, I tend to try to specify in a way that is, I hope, hopefully logical, an outline so that you can take that away and think about it, but I tend to sort of speak fairly ad lib and off the top of my head, so a lot of the things that come up in later sessions I've already talked about, and that's happened again now. But I just want to emphasise in this first point that are we wanting to become like Jesus, or do we want to become like Moses or some other person? And the answer has to be, you want to become like Jesus. Well, then the question is, can we become like Jesus if all we see is the exemplary preaching? So I've put it down simply in terms which are fairly stark, but which I think are worth considering whenever we're setting out to deal particularly with an Old Testament passage, is, are we preaching Christ or are we preaching man? And the answer, I think, is obvious. You could probably, without thinking too hard, think of the times when you've heard Christian sermons or convention addresses which have sort of picked the eyes out of some prominent Old Testament character without very much reference at all to how that relates to the gospel. It seems to me that means you end up, in a sense, with two Bibles and almost two religions. One is in the Old Testament, one is in the New Testament. So once again, you come back to the question of how do we perceive the unity of the whole Bible? And I've already told you how I think you do that. The confusion over the relationship of the for us and the in us is one which all I can do is urge you to think on constantly and to be aware of the, you might say, the grammar of salvation. And the grammar of salvation is frequently reflected in the grammar of the language of the Bible. That is, ask yourself why you have an imperative when you have an imperative. And usually the imperatives in the Greek or the Hebrew come through in the English translations if they're a halfway good one. Now, there's some halfway terrible ones too, which I would not like people to use. And Bible translation is just another whole area which we don't have time to go into, but you know, I'm sure we're all aware that we have our preferences and we ask questions as to why we have them. It came up for me in the little home group I joined at the church we're at now, and, you know, we'd read around the passage, we'd say, you know, we'll read Acts chapter 1, so we'd divide up the number of verses and around we'd go. And out of, you know, 8 or 10 people, there would be, you know, 6 or 7 different versions. And, you know, somebody said, it gets confusing, doesn't all these different versions? I said, yes, it does. And I said, some of them are not very good versions either, because some types of you know, Bible translation work on a principle which seems to be tailor-made to hide what the text is saying rather than to elucidate it. And we were talking about this at lunchtime, about how, you know, you have in Bible translation there's sort of a continuum between what they call dynamic equivalence, which looks at the sense, the concept which is there, and the formal equivalence which looks at the words that are there. And the problem for Bible translators is not an easy one. You need to be aware of that when you're praying next to your friends there in Wycliffe and so on. It's a tremendously difficult task, because you say, well, if we work on the one end of the continuum of dynamic equivalence, we go for the concept. The fact is that the word of God has come to us in words, not concepts. The concepts have been conveyed by words, and sometimes the words are put in such a way that if you simply go for the concept, you fail to see the connection between the concept as it's conveyed there and the concept as it's conveyed somewhere else. And the classic example that we were mentioning is that, that when the translators pick up the Aramaic of Son of Man in Daniel 7 and translate it as one like a human being, it totally eradicates the connection, which I believe is there, with when Jesus says that he is the Son of Man, and you don't see the connection. So that's another area that we need to look at and bear in mind. Go for a good translation. And this, of course, is why in theological colleges some of us still believe in teaching Greek and Hebrew. Many of them have ceased to do it, taking the line of least resistance because they believe it's too hard. But for pastors who have wrestled with Greek and Hebrew and know really the blood, sweat and tears that are involved, we still think it's worth it because there are not too many people who will go out into their pastorates and be able to pick up the New Testament or the Old Testament in their original languages and be able to read it. But what they will be able to do is sort through when there is a problem or when a commentary does refer them to something in the original language as a point of distinction or something worth noting. So that's another area that most of us have to depend upon the experts, and usually the expertise is at the level of Bible translation. So make sure you use good ones for preaching and teaching. I've already made the point that the only way to grow is to go on with the gospel, not from the gospel, and the only way to grow is in terms of the gospel. And I don't want to keep hammering that one. So if we agree that the way we grow as Christians, not only become a Christian, but the way we grow as Christians is through our relationship to Jesus Christ, then we must either discard the Old Testament or we must use it as a means to helping people grow into Christ. Now, might be a good point here to ask is, does anybody want to ask a question at this point? I'm happy to field anything now. I think I've probably said enough provocative things to get you going. Yes, Greg. Yep. Okay, that's worth doing. Again, as I understand it, what is happening in allegory is that a concept is picked up on, or even some words, and removed from its historical context because the historical context is seen as compromising it. Now, if you're aware, how allegory crept into the Christian church, it came in via the Jews in Alexandria, and they learned it from the Greeks. And it was a Greek trick to enable Greek philosophy and Greek religious thought to be somehow joined up. See, so if you've got something that looks sort of mythological on one end, and you've got a whole bunch of people who are thinking hard-headed sort of philosophy and stuff, what you do then to make the two sort of compatible is you start interpreting the mythology as something which is simply mythologically referring to something else. And the way you get from that to the something else may depend on what sort of framework you're working from, whether it's Greek philosophy or, in the case of the Jews, working from the history of the Old Testament through to a more sort of Hellenistic way of thinking. Now, the way then it worked with the Christians was that it was really a way of handling the problem of the Old Testament, I suppose, first and foremost. And the early Christian allegorists, people like Origen and Clement in Alexandria, learned this trick. But what was going to be the framework which they used? Well, there were two basic ones. One was the New Testament and the other was church doctrine. So rather than seeing the the particular concept, the text, or the institution, the person, or the event within its historical context, and looking at that in terms of the redemptive historical progress from Abraham through and so on and so forth. It was just simply the idea that was there. So I mentioned the one about the stuff on the priest's robe, the pomegranates embroidered on the priest's robe. And instead of asking how they functioned in the law, prescriptions in Exodus for the making of the priest's robe, and the answer might be, oh, decoration. He's an important guy. He ought to have important-looking clothes. From a framework of Christian theology, this particular Bible teacher said, pomegranates, fruit of the Spirit. The idea that Christ is in all the Scriptures. Others have gone from the fact that the Ark of the Covenant was made of wood and overlaid with gold. Well, wood equals humanity, gold equals divinity. So the gold overlaid wood is typological of the person of Christ and his two natures. Never mind the fact that it speaks of a particular heresy called Nestorianism. Now that was sort of what the allegorists did. Now typology developed later. The typologists were determined to maintain the historical meaning of the text. And what they said was not that here's an idea and we'll use, the first thing that comes into your mind, which is perhaps conditioned by church doctrine or something else, to give it a spiritual meaning, because I can't see any spiritual meaning in the form that it's got. That's the way the allegorists worked. The typologist said, no, here is something that happened in history. It functioned in a certain way spiritually at that point and finds an answer in something further on where the same basic concept comes up but at a greater and more advanced level. And so the sacrifices in the Old Testament were in various ways seen as typological of Christ and his sacrifice. And they were given the clue from some of the direct links made in the New Testament, like Paul saying, Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. So I suppose the key difference is the allegorists were not interested in the historical context of the original text. The typologists were determined to maintain it and to understand the meaning as being drawn from the links made in the Bible itself. Yes, Peter.
Somewhere Gerardus Voss says that the entrance to the house of typology is at the farther end of the house of symbolism, by which he's making the point that something has to be a symbol before it can be a type. What do you think of that?
I think Voss also makes the point that something can be quite literally happening and therefore in its own context is not symbol. He makes this point in his biblical theology about the story of the Garden of Eden, that historical events can be symbolic of something else. So you see, you really have to pin down what you mean by symbol.
Representing some spiritual truth, I suppose.
Well, or representing something else. I mean, you walk out the road there are symbols. Whether you take any notice or not is up to how you drive, but there are symbols out there, like stop signs, speed signs, traffic lights. They're all symbols. No good saying, like the lady who speaks with the red sign, red traffic light, said, well, seen one, seen them all. You interpret the symbol in that particular context. Now, I think what Voss is saying, with regard to the story of Eden, that historic events can be symbolic of something else. And see, the trouble with spiritual, what do we mean by spiritual? That's one too. That so typology, and I suppose I'd agree with what you're saying there. I mean, I just want to know how to pin it down. In the Old Testament, things were not necessarily seen as typological at that point. As I don't think, Now, here I disagree with the guy I was asked to debate when I was in England 3 years ago, who believes that Abraham knew the full gospel and that we were saved by faith in Jesus Christ. My retort to that was, well, if he knew that, he should have been flogged for not saying so. Fancy hiding that great truth from us all. If Moses knew the full gospel, he ought to be flogged for not saying so. I just find that incredible. So I don't think that Moses would have grasped the point at that stage. And so he stopped now and said, you know, well, what are the laws of burnt offering symbolic of? I don't know whether he could have given much of an answer to that. He'd say, this is what the Lord requires of us. If we are obedient, we believe that we are forgiven. And so on.
Wouldn't that say, represent the fact that we need our sins forgiven and that God is prepared to accept some kind of a substitute?
Oh, sure, that's an interpretation. Oh, okay, if that's what you mean, that's fine, I don't know the problem of that. And that just goes to the fact that everything's symbol, every word you utter is a symbol.
Yeah, I suppose, maybe.
Yeah.
Just a quote that I've...
Okay. I think Greg's question, however, is important because you will find, if you start talking about typology, you'll have people waltzing up to you and say, oh, I thought allegory was, you know, not a good thing to do. I'll say, well, I'm talking about allegory. So you want to be very clear about the distinction between allegory and typology. And then somebody will float by, you know, the reference to Paul using allegory in Galatians. And the question is whether he uses the word there in exactly the same way as it was generally used, whether that is a true allegory. It may be, but I think it's more than allegory. See, Paul is not just waltzing off into the nether gloom, the unknown, and picking something out of the air. He's not doing like Stephen Langton, the 12th century Archbishop of Canterbury, who said that when Boaz asks the question when he sees Ruth gleaning in the fields, whose maid is this? Now, see, if I was to put that in front of you as a text and say, well, what are you going to do with this one? So you'd put it in that context, and, you know, the whole narration about Ruth and how it goes and how it ends up. But Stephen Langton said, no, the significance of this is that the bishop is inquiring of his ordinand whether he is sufficiently gleaned in the scriptures to be ordained as a priest. He said, well, man, you know... top marks for imagination. And when the king of Israel falls through the lattice window and hurts himself, the significance of this to Stephen Langton was the bishop who came a moral cropper. Now that's the sort of thing, you see, that it was uncontrolled spiritualizing of the text. I have nothing against spiritualizing because I think the New Testament does it. I don't know whether there's anybody here who believes that prophecy has to be interpreted literally. By now you'll have realised I don't believe that. But I've had it said to me on more than one occasion, if you don't interpret prophecy literally, you'll make it mean anything you like. And all I can say is that's rubbish. You could make it mean anything you like. You can make it mean anything you like if you try and interpret it literally. Because it's simply impossible to interpret all the prophecies literally. Without having them clash all the way along the line. But spiritualizing is a word which can be given a perfectly legitimate meaning if you understand it in terms of the way the New Testament picks up and applies the meaning of concrete events and real people in the Old Testament history as being fulfilled in the spiritual work of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. Okay? That is the real spiritualizing. So in my view, there is no such biblical hermeneutical principle of interpretation which says literal. Jesus Christ is the hermeneutic principle of the Bible. Christological interpretation of the Old Testament is the way Jesus and the apostles and the New Testament writers in general proceed. And I think that is so important. Anybody else want to come in on that? I don't want to tread on any toes, but I feel strongly about that one, and I think it's important that we don't just follow some tradition that we've been brought up without thinking through the implications of it. All right. The second point that I make in this section is that the vital question, how does this text testify to Jesus? And we've talked about this all day. But I still wanted to put it here so that it's here. Can I preach a Christian sermon without mentioning Jesus? Now, I know that there are a lot of people who disagree with me on this. My first question is that, why on earth would you want to? Why would you want to preach a sermon without mentioning Jesus? I mean, Jesus tells us, Jesus is the final word about God. Jesus is the final word about humanity. Jesus is the final word about the creation. He's the final word about everything. And it seems to me that it's, you know, it's really strange to want to preach a Christian sermon without the Christian part of it. Now, let me just add this, and I've made this point in the book on preaching, that I believe there are different strategies that apply in different situations. So I don't want to go off half-cocked on this one. If, for instance, as I have been, a member of, say, a home study group, home group in local church, and as one, when we were back in Sydney, at one stage we were working through the book of Samuel. Now, the expectation was that every time we met, whether it was weekly or fortnightly, I forget which, most of us would be there. We'd be there if we could be. And there would be continuity. So it never bothered me if we went through a study and never got beyond, you might say, the close reading of the text, what was actually being said in the book of Samuel. Never asked the Jesus question. Never bothered me. Because I knew sooner or later we would have to get to that question. And we'd all be in on it. In fact, what intrigued me was, without any prompting for me, I found people constantly bringing up the Jesus question. We didn't get very far in the text about Samuel without somebody wanting to ask the Jesus question. So that's one strategy. I would not be pushing the Jesus question. Second one would be Christian parents. When dad is leading his wife and kids in, you know, Bible reading and prayers, however you do it, according to the age of your kids. Say you're working through the story of Moses and the Exodus. Once again, the fact that they're there, they'll be there tomorrow, the day after, and following week, and so on, the expectation is that it's going to be continuous. I would not, you know, get my shirt in the knot if the Jesus question didn't come up for a week or two. But sooner or later it'll come up, or it should. But I do agree with my friend John Chapman, who said, if somebody wanders into your church one day, whether they've been brought by a friend or whether they just, for whatever reason, just passing the door and saying, I wonder what they're on about, and comes in, and if that person sits down and actually listens, they ought to be able to go away knowing what we are on about. And is it not true that out there, and you hear it through the various media, people commenting about churches and so on, about religion, but the ordinary person, if they think about religion at all, about Christianity, thinks that Christianity is about being good so that God will accept you and you go to heaven when you die. So the last thing we want to do is to give them the impression that that's what we're on about. And the only way to do that, I think, is to make sure that a sermon at some point gets round to the issue of grace and forgiveness and so on, insofar as it's appropriate to the text. And it may be fairly peripheral, but... Yes, Sandra?
Can I ask a bit of a mystic question there?
Yeah.
Were you saying you couldn't preach a sermon without mentioning how it relates to the gospel rather than mentioning Jesus? So could you certainly preach a sermon that mentions an aspect of the gospel in terms of God's character or the way it relates to the gospel without actually mentioning it?
Well, I suppose you could, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound wooden on this, but, yeah, I suppose my first reaction to that would be the character of God gets its final and definitive expression in the person and work of Jesus. And in the end, you see, I suppose one reason why I would prefer not to do it that way, not, you know, by choice, is that people talk about G-O-D, God, all over the place. Whereas, and they will have the idea that God means the same thing to everybody. Now, I know that you can have something the same problem with Jesus, but at least if you can pin it down to the person and work of Jesus, I think you're getting closer to the implication of the gospel.
Would it be a principle of text selection? Somebody raised this question before about, you know, the size of the text. You
yep.
said the whole Bible testifies to Christ.
Mm.
And you also said that little bits may not, polygrams.
Yep.
Somewhere in between those extremes, should we try and pick our text, say the Old Testament narratives, make them big enough so we get to the point where we can preach Christ? In other words, is this a principle of text selection?
I think it probably is. I don't think there's too much problem when you're dealing with, say, narrative stuff. If you recognise that narrative units at least have to include some sort of meaningful action and character building and all that sort of thing. Probably one of the more difficult ones is like preaching on Proverbs. Particularly the sentence literature in chapter 10 and following. You could be very nitpicky and moralistic by just taking one or two proverbs. And it's not easy to do. And I have to say, you know, that I haven't preached on Proverbs very much. But I remember, I think the last time I did so, I took the whole of chapter 10 as one of my sermons in which I showed how the writer was concerned to make the distinction between wise and fool, righteous and wicked, and how that, and then that raises the question as to what do we mean by wisdom and folly, what do we mean by righteousness and wickedness, and that sort of leads you then to try to unpack the whole concept. And once you're doing that, I'll be doing a bit of that tomorrow when we get on to Solomon. Once you get onto that, you get into areas which actually take you far beyond what the average person thinks they're all about. Whereas if you just took one, you know, and you see this constant, here's a guy who, whether he was responsible for all these proverbs, which is fairly unlikely, but he's certainly responsible for putting them all together in one chapter like this. And he obviously wants us to get the hang of the idea that righteousness and wickedness, wisdom and folly, are opposite ends of the spectrum, which impinge in so many different ways upon the way we understand our just ordinary day-to-day living. And that, to me, then leads us to raise the questions as to how they perceived these concepts in the wider context. So yeah, I think your text selection, it comes back to what is the textual unit. And this is pretty important, for instance, in the prophets, because sometimes it's very difficult to know where a prophetic oracle begins and ends. And also, you know, it raises the whole question as to how the prophetic oracle is structured and whether it does matter where it begins and ends. Mostly, I think it does. Yeah. Anything else while I'm having a drink? Okay. Well, the third point is the process from exegesis to sermon application, which is really my last point, and I'm feeling all talked out, and you're probably feeling all listened out. But just, you know, anything that you want to discuss on this will be fair game. But this is sort of my way of leading into tomorrow's discussions. The logic of from text via exegesis and hermeneutics to sermon. What is the logic? I would like to, you know, there's a lot of things we can talk about here, but I'd just like to feed into you the possibility that exegesis is not a self-evident exercise. But exegesis is actually a theological exercise. that we may not need to reflect on it, but actually I think it's a good idea to perhaps to think and realise that it's there. From my way of thinking, it does link with the whole doctrine of word and language and the way God is communicated by word. So it's quite a fascinating study, really, you know, as to how word becomes so central to the biblical idea of communication. The very fact that God is seen as creating by his word. Now, why did he use word? Does that literally mean, you know, a great voice boomed out? And how can God have a voice if he doesn't have a voice box and air to pass over and this sort of thing? So that's not the point. But the fact that the concept of word, which then becomes so central to the way human beings think and act and communicate and so on, that the Bible tells us that God created the whole universe by a word, and that it was a word that was self-authenticating. That is, nothing had to sort of sit back and say, yeah, hang on, we better test this one and see if there's any truth in it before anything happened. God spoke and it happened. He didn't snap his fingers to bring the universe into being. He didn't think it into being. He spoke it into being. And I think part of that, and this is only a part, is that the Bible is impressing upon us the fact that as those who are created in the image of God, we are created as speakers. And we are created in God's image so that we can understand the Word of God. And there's a sense in which the Word of God is self-authenticating. Now, I'm making a point of this because some of you, if not all of you, will at some time have encountered the fairly recent phenomenon which we put under the broad umbrella of postmodernism. And in the study of how the Bible has been interpreted, the emphasis has shifted, just as in the sort of the criticism of biblical texts and so on, the emphasis has shifted from trying to understand what the original author intended to say. That, of course, raised questions as to which author do we mean? Do we mean the ultimate author, God? Or do we mean the human author who was responsible for writing it down in the way that it was transmitted to us? And then, of course, you'd have the further question of somebody else passing it on to us. But how is it? So the whole emphasis shifted from... That was the emphasis at one stage. We actually used to refer to that as literary criticism and source criticism. And those of you who have had to study this sort of stuff will know the sort of excruciating business of sorting through JEDP and how many people wrote the Pentateuch and this sort of stuff, and how many eyes there were. Much further along the way, the emphasis changed in a way that had the potential for a great deal of good. That was, the emphasis shifted from trying to understand who wrote and how many sources there were to what actually is the text on about. What is the text saying? So people were no longer sort of turning themselves inside out to try and work out whether there was one...
This recording is brought to you by thechristianlibrary.org.au.